Okay, this evening we are moving towards the close of Chumash Vayikra, and we have the two parshas of Behar and Mefukosai separate, so we get a chance to take a good look at each. And I'd like to begin this evening by taking a look at opening Rashi. It's a well-known Rashi, certainly the Rashi's question, probably one of the most famous questions of Rashi in the Torah. The opening section of Parshas Behar is the mitzvah of Shemitah. And the Parsha begins, Perek Kafei Pasuk Aleph. In fact, almost all of this week's Parsha is Vayikra Perek Kafei, just another one or two psukim at the end. But Pasuk Aleph reads, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Bahar Sinai Lemor. So we have the famous, specific, and explicit association of Har Sinai together with the mitzvahs of Shemitah. And this leads Rashi to ask famously, Ma Inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai? Why is Shemitah mentioned specifically in connection with Har Sinai? Balo kol mitzvahs nemru b'Sinai. All mitzvahs were said from Sinai. The pasuk tells us in the end of Bechukosai, Eile ha-mitzvahs, Hashet Tziva Hashem, Bahar Sinai. All mitzvahs are given at Sinai. Moshe kibol Torah mi Sinai. Ella, what it comes to teach us is perhaps something that we wouldn't have known. Mitzvahs have general themes and then details and particulars. How much of that was given at Sinai? Ella, rather, ma shmita ne'emru kloloseha uprotoseha v'dikdukeha misinai. Just like shmita was given kloloseha, its general principles, uprotoseha and its details, v'dikdukeha and its particulars, misinai, from Sinai, afkulan ne'emru kloloseen v'dikdukehen misinai. So too, all mitzvahs were given. Not only the general aspects of the themes of the mitzvah, but also the particulars of the mitzvah, all 613. The background, on a basic level, but to be aware of the background to Rashi's comment, is a well-known dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael in terms of understanding how much of the Torah was given at Sinai. Indeed, according to Rabbi Ishmael, it is only the klalim, the general themes of the mitzvah that were given at Sinai. Protim, the details, were given later on, throughout the course of the stay in the wilderness, through Ohel Moed, through communication in the Mishkan. That is Rabbi Yishmael's position. Klalim at Sinai, protim later on in Ohel Moed. Whereas Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that everything about the mitzvahs was given at Sinai, klalim and protim, and was then reviewed in Ohel Moed. So Rashi is paskening, so to speak, to the extent that one paskens in matters such as this. He's at the very least explaining the meaning and message of the pasuk as reflecting the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. All mitzvahs were given, klalim and protim, at Sinai. It's important to mention before we get roll up our sleeves in the Rashi itself. And this is something that Rav Kupperman would point out on many occasions, in fact, whenever he could, that when we talk about the idea of Moshe receiving the Torah from Sinai, the totality of the Torah from Sinai, it's very important to distinguish between two meanings of Torah. There is Torah in terms of the contents of the 613 mitzvos, and there is Torah in terms of the text of the Chumash. And it's crucial to differentiate between the two. When we say that Moshe received the entirety of the Torah from Sinai, that means he receives the contents of all the mitzvahs. It by no means, and cannot possibly mean, that Moshe received the entirety of the text of the Chumash at Har Sinai. Because if he received the whole text of the Chumash at Sinai, he would know a lot of things that he did not know at that time he would know, if he read Parshas Kisisa, that the Jewish people were making the golden calf. He would also know, if he read Parshas Shelach, not to send spies, and he would certainly know not to hit the rock when he got to Parshas Chukas. Needless to say, it is impossible that he is receiving the text which describes events that had not actually taken place. When the text of the Torah was given to Moshe was after those events had taken place. And that is a separate discussion in the Talmud in Maseches Gittin on Daf Samach, whether it was given in installments each time after the event, what is known as Megillah Megillah, piece by piece, scroll by scroll, or perhaps the entirety of the text of the Torah was only given at the end of the 40 years. That's the opinion of Chasuma Nitna, in one blow. So Moshe for sure did not receive an art scroll Chumash at Har Sinai, or any other Chumash for that matter. When we say he received the Torah in its entirety, it refers specifically to the contents of the 613 mitzvahs. But be that as it may, let us come back and try and do justice to this Rashi. And we note at the outset that Rashi has stated two things. Rashi's message is built on two ideas. Number one, identifying that the totality of Shemitah was given at Har Sinai, general and particular. And from there, extending that idea to all of the 613 mitzvahs. When you put those two together, you get the message according to Rashi. And many Mefarshim are bothered by how this can be said. Ramban spearheads the pushback here. And he asks the following. The first idea to derive from the verse, namely that Shemitah was given in totem at Sinai, that is relatively reasonable. After all, the Pasuk explicitly associates Har Sinai with Shemitah, and therefore one is entitled to assume that that means that all of Shemitah was given at Sinai. But with regards to the extrapolation to all other mitzvahs, we appear to have taken a liberty of sorts. After all, the Pasuk only spoke about Shemitah. It didn't speak about other mitzvahs. How do we know that what was stated with regards to Shemitah is equally true for the other 612? And if you can't answer that question, you're not entitled to extrapolate from Shemitah outwards. That is the question. Once again, one can reasonably infer that Shemitah was given totally at Sinai. How do we know about the other psukim, the other mitzvahs? I'd like to suggest a radical approach to understanding Rashi's intent, and that is to read the Rashi until the end. And the reason why that's so radical is because I think most people stop at the point where we stopped, perhaps not even recognizing or realizing that Rashi actually hasn't even said anything yet. Because everything that we have quoted is actually Rashi citing the Toras Kohanim, the halachic medrash at the beginning of Bahar. So Rashi has actually not yet had his own input. Let us see how Rashi proceeds to process this Toras Kohanim. It's quite an amazing situation because Rashi will now give us a shiur. He'll give us a lesson in how to learn the Toras Kohanim. We have quoted and left off, just like Shemitah, so too all other mitzvahs. Says Rashi, Kach shanui b'Toras Kohanim. Thus it has been taught in Toras Kohanim, which is the Medrash Halacha of Chumash Vayikra. And Rashi continues, V'nir ali shekach perusha. I believe that the meaning is as follows. Lefi shelomatzinu shmitas karkaos shenishnes ba'arvos moav b'mishna Torah. You see, we never find that Shemitah of land, giving the land a rest, is mentioned again in the plains of Moab, that is to say in Mishnah Torah, Chumash Devarim. There's no mention of Shemitah of land in Chumash Devarim. Okay, Lamadnu, from there we learn, apparently, that it was all given beforehand. Shaklalo Seha or Proto Seha, Kulon Nermu Misinai. that the general and particulars of Shmiter were all given from Sinai. And the Pasuk now comes to teach us further, Al kol dibur shenidbar l'Moshe, regarding every commandment that was given to Moshe, Shemisinai hayu kulam. They were all from Sinai, klalosehem v'dikdukehem, in general and particular. So to summarize Rashi's explanation, we can infer from the absence of any mention of Shemitah in Chumash Devarim that it was already given totally before Chumash Devarim, otherwise known as Sinai. Our pasuk is coming to teach us that the same is true for all mitzvos. The question is, what has Rashi explained? How has he helped us? The question seemingly is still there. How do you know that what's true of Shemitah is true of all other mitzvahs? Maybe Shemitah is different. And in fact, we now have an additional question. Namely, according to Rashi, if you wish to know how we can infer that Shemitah was given in totality at Sinai, both Klalim and Pratim, it's very simply a function of the fact that it was never mentioned again in Chumash Devarim. Why then do I need the Pasuk to say Behar Sinai at Shemitah to teach me that Shemitah was given totally at Sinai? I know that from its absence in Chumash Devarim. All of this is explained in the most elegant fashion by one of the early Mefarshim on Rashi's Perush. As we know, Rashi's commentary itself is graced by many, many super commentaries. Some of them are more famous, some less. One of the early commentaries is called Sefer HaZikaron, written by Rabbi Avram Bukharat. And I believe it's already from the 1400s. And he explains that Rashi himself is coming to anticipate this question. And again, to be crystal clear, the question is, how do you know that what's true of Shemitah is true for all other mitzvahs? How do you know that Shemitah represents the 613? Maybe it's the exception among the 613 in being given totally at Sinai. To that, Rashi comes to answer, very simply. I already know that Shemitah was given totally at Sinai from the fact that it has no mention in Chumash Devarim. So that much I know. And now I see that the Torah makes additional mention of Har Sinai in the context of Shemitah. My problem is, to teach me what? If it's to teach me that Shemitah is given totally at Sinai, that I know from its absence in Chumash Devarim. And still the Pasuk is teaching me something. But if it's not teaching me what I already know, it must then be coming to teach me something that I don't yet know. Namely, that not only is Shemitah given totally at Sinai, both Klalim and Pratim, but also the other mitzvahs as well. In other words, if we can summarize what the Sefer HaZikaron has said, there's clearly a message about Sinai coming from the Pasuk. Once it's redundant regarding Shemitah itself, it then shines outwards to all the other mitzvahs, giving me the result that all mitzvahs were given at Sinai, Klalim and Pratim, as per the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. I'd like to add that perhaps if this is the message, according to Rashi, namely, without the Torah's mention of Har Sinai, I would only know that mitzvahs that I will not find again in Chumash Devarim, I can assume were given totally at Sinai. Comes along the Torah's mention of Har Sinai to tell me that even mitzvahs that I will find in Chumash Devarim were also given at Har Sinai totally. That's the before and after. If that's the case, and if that's the message, then I wonder whether we can then understand an additional point. Namely, Smichus Parshios. A classic thing that Rashi engages in. Here he doesn't, but let's try. Smichus Parshios is to understand how one Parsha follows on from another. And let us see what Shemitah follows on from. Well, the beginning of Bahar, if we may skip over the Haftorah, follows on from the end of Parshas Emor. And what is at the very end of Parshas Emor? The episode with the Mekalel, the one who blasphemed Hashem's name, and then he was stoned to death. And that's the end of Emor, and we move straight into Shemitah. And if I can paraphrase Rashi's words and ask a question that I'm not sure that other Meforshim or many other Meforshim have asked. Ma inyan Shemitah etzel Mekalel? What is the topic of Shemitah doing following on from this episode of this blasphemer? They don't seem to have anything in common. But perhaps they do. The very final words, if we take a look at the final pasuk in Parshas Emor, Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Vayidaber Moshe al Bnei Yisrael, Moshe spoke to Bnei Yisrael, Vayotziu es hamekalel al michutz lamachana, they took the blasphemer outside the camp, Vayigmu oso oven, and they stoned him. And then the final words of the pasuk and of the parsha, Uvnei Yisrael asu kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe. And Bnei Yisrael did, in accordance with everything Hashem commanded Moshe. Are those final words grounds for comment? Do they need to be explained? Indeed they do. They seem to be completely redundant. The pasuk has described the Jewish people doing everything they were told to do. Why then does the pasuk then state in conclusion that they did everything they were told to do? That is a pshat question. And Rashi provides an answer. When it says in the final words that Bnei Yisrael did what Hashem told Moshe, says Rashi, not only the actual stoning itself, but rather kol ha-mitzvah ha-amura b'skila, b'makam acher, even aspects of the mitzvah of stoning, it is a mitzvah, that are mentioned elsewhere. Because there are three elements to that mitzvah. Dechia, the person is pushed from a height, regima, stoned, and tliya, and then he's hanged. It's obviously a very serious mitzvah. This is not material for a Sheva Brachos drasha, but we need to contend with what the pasuk is saying. And according to Rashi, the final words are saying that the Jewish people fulfilled the mitzvah in total, with all of its elements. The pushing, the stoning, and the hanging. And now, let us consider something very interesting. Where are those elements described in the Torah? Well, the pushing is described actually earlier in Parshas Yisro, Yaro Yireh. But what about the idea that once a person has been executed, he's hanged for a while to serve as a deterrent? Where is that stated in the Chumash? I think we know. It's in Parshas Kisetse. V'chi yevi ish chet mishpat maves v'humas, if a person is sentenced to death and killed, v'salisa oso al eitz, he should be hanged from a tree. What is very interesting about this Rashi now? According to Rashi, we have a real live example of a mitzvah that is only spoken about in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Kisetze, but it was already known and acted upon earlier on, as early as Parshas Emor, where they're yet at Har Sinai. What does this teach us? It is an example of a mitzvah. It won't be mentioned, it won't be written in the Chumash until Chumash Devarim, but it's already known to them, informationally, even if not textually. That is exactly what the opening Rashi of Bahar is all about. And that's the Smichus Parshios, because the Pasuk now tells us that what you just saw at the end of Emor, a mitzvah which is written in Devarim, was already known, is true for all mitzvahs in Devarim. They were all already known. That's the lesson that we learn from Shemitah. Just like Shemitah, which is not mentioned in Chumash Devarim, and therefore clearly known in Totem, so to all mitzvahs, even those that are mentioned in Chumash Devarim, were already known, as per the example of the stoning of the Mekalel at the end of Parshas Emor. I believe that that could give us an inkling into the Smichus Parshios of the end of Emor to the beginning of Behar. Just before we move on to other matters, there is a wonderful comment of the Kliokar. who, and of course there's so much drash going on, drash in the homiletic sense, with regards to the connection of Shemitah and Har Sinai. The truth is, the first station that we checked in at as a nation to stay for a while was Har Sinai. And what did we do at Har Sinai? We were learning Torah, we were receiving Torah. It became extended somewhat. We needed more time, apparently, in the wilderness. But the opening stage, the formational stage of the Jewish people, is purely to be learning and connecting with Torah. Now, as we know, for most people, that is not how things will remain indefinitely. As they transition into the land of Israel, so people will be working the land, people will be occupying themselves with making a living, and so on and so forth, and that is true for most people. A minority may stay in what is called Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, the full-time learning, but the majority will be balancing their learning with working for a living. However, even though in general, in principle, we went from Sinai to the land of Israel, from learning to earning a living and being occupied at a livelihood, from time to time, in order to be sure that you do not lose the plot, in order that your occupation does not become a preoccupation, and in order that your livelihood does not become the totality of your life, the Jewish people need to take time out. Once every 7 years. Shemitah is Shabbos Lashem. And it is as much about giving the people a rest from the land as it is about giving the land a rest from people. The land is doing okay. People need a rest from the land. They need to be sure that they maintain their perspective, not only about life generally, but even about what they're doing when they're working the land. And where do they go during the seventh year? Conceptually, they go back to Sinai. In other words, the ideal fulfillment of the Shemitah is to take a year off, literally a sabbatical, and to recharge again with Torah learning, with all that goes with that. And therefore, says the Kli Yakar, in answer to the question, Ma inyan Shemitah etzel Har Sinai, why does Har Sinai have a special mention within the context of Shemitah? Because Shemitah is all about Har Sinai. It's about getting you back to Har Sinai once every 7 years so that you remember what it is that you're doing in the land. Very beautiful comment from the Kli Yakar. So from Shemitah, we move to Yovel. And what do we find in Psukim Tes and Yud? What are we told about Yovel? Pasuk Tes, Vahavarta, Shofar Tru'a B'Chodesh HaShvi, so the shofar is sounded in the seventh month, Be'asor L'Chodesh, which is B'Yom HaKippurim. And what is affected in the Yovel year, in the 50th year? As the Pasuk says, count seven lots of 7 years, and then in the year 50, V'Kidashtem Esk Shnas HaChamishim Shana. And you shall sanctify the 50th year, Ukurasem Doror Ba'aretz Lechol Yoshveha. Ukurasem Doror, famous words, you shall proclaim freedom, you shall proclaim liberty in the land, Lechol Yoshveha. That is the Doror Yikra. In other words, one of the central mitzvahs of Yovel is that even those who have been in servitude, indentured, into servitude for long term, comes the Yovel, everyone goes free. And I would like to raise a simple question. What is the meaning of the word deror? It's easy to translate as liberty. But why does deror mean liberty? Interestingly, the Gemara, which is in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and Daf Tes, gives a very specific rendition of the meaning of the word deror. In the words of the Gemara, short sentence, we'll read and translate, kidemedayer beidaira, a person can live wherever he wants, dira, a person can live wherever he wants, umischa bechol hamedina, and he can do business wherever he wants. That is the Gemara's explanation of Deror. You can live where you want, you can do business where you want. And the question is, how does Deror come to mean that? The Ksava Kabbalah, and as we know, one of the specialties of the Ksava Kabbalah, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Becklenburg, is the words of Lashon HaKodesh to understand how they mean what they mean. And that is that the Gemara is explaining that the word Deror comes from the word Lador, to live. We conveniently translate Deror as freedom. But specifically, Deror doesn't mean free. Deror means living. It comes from the word Dira. So Ukrasem Deror, and that is the first part of the Gemara's explanation. Kidimidair Beidari, you can live where you want. If you're someone's servant, you have to live on premises. But if you're free, you can live wherever you want. Deror, your Dira can be wherever you want. It's very interesting that this is not the first time that Chazal have taken the letters Dalet Reish and explained them as living. It's actually happened in last week's Parsha as well, on the very words Peri Eitz Hadar. And Rashi cites it. The Gemara says in Sukkah, in identifying what is the Peri Eitz Hadar. So if translation was ever an easy process, it's Peri Eitz Hadar. It's an Esrog. But how is Peri Eitz Hadar an Esrog? The Gemara explains that the words Peri Eitz Hadar are defining the unique characteristics of an Esrog. It happens to be that an Esrog stays on a tree for a long time, from one year to the next. When other fruits are falling off, the Esrog is still there. And that is why it's called Peri Eitz Hadar, says the Gemara. Pre Shedar ba'ilan, it lives in the tree. Mishana l'shana, Peri Eitz Hadar, it lives in the tree. And here we see, once again, that the word dar is darshaned as an expression of living somewhere. Very interesting. It is especially interesting because, to the best of my knowledge, the word ladur or dira does not appear anywhere in Tanakh as meaning to dwell. We say dira, dira arba, dira whatever. We've adopted it as a dwelling place. It's used in Chazal, dira, and clearly hadar, etc., to dwell. But the Chumash, I believe the Tanakh, certainly the Chumash, does not use the word dar meaning to dwell. So it's very interesting that we expound the word hadar, meaning living, whereas the word dar itself, as a Hebrew word, doesn't mean to live. I believe that in Aramaic, the word dar means to live, which means that a further leap of the drasha here is that it darshans the word hadar, which is a Hebrew word, beauty, hadar, and associates it with an Aramaic word. And drashas sometimes do that. And in fact, to darshan a word based on an Aramaic association is relatively mild, because Aramaic is actually quite close. But we find much more extreme examples in the Gemara, where they darshan words in the Chumash based on words in other languages which have nothing to do with Hebrew, ostensibly. And in fact, a classic example is another of the drushers on Peri Eitz Hadar. Because the Gemara says, you know what another characteristic of the Esrog is? It requires a great deal of water. Gadel al kol mayim. What's it got to do with Hadar? The Mefarshim explain. The Gemara is associating the word Hadar with Hydra, with water. Peri Eitz Hadar means a hydrated fruit, because it needs a lot of water. And that's a Greek word. And the meaning behind all of this, which is a fascinating explanation, is in the drushes of Rabbi Yoshua ibn Shuib, who was a student of the Rashba. And he explains, I heard this from my father, Zatzal, many years ago, that originally everyone was Safa Achat. Everyone spoke the same language. Rashi says, Lashon HaKodesh. Then in the Tower of Babel, things got all mixed up and it got fragmented into 70 languages. But some of those languages yet maintain a spark or a nuance of the original Hebrew. And Chazal, with their knowledge, knew when to reach into another language and say, that actually was originally a Lashon HaKodesh word. And an example is Hadar for Hydra and Dar for Hadar, etc. and so forth. So these are all very, very fascinating ideas, which can, of course, be taken and explored much, much further. But that's the word Dar we see is an expression of Dira. You can live where you want, back to Daror. The question is, let us remind ourselves there were two parts to the sentence as to what Daror means. You can live where you want, you can do business where you want. Where did business come into to the word Daror? Well, the word Sechora itself, Sechora, Mischar, which we translate as business, Rashi has already explained that the word sechora actually comes from the concept of lisovev, to go around. And again, lahavdil, we are familiar with that. If a person has turned around many times, he receives what's called scharchoret, because he's turned around. Socher, and Rashi, these are his words, Yosef says to the brothers, as he's being Yosef and they don't yet know that he says, You can do business throughout the land. Ve'es ha'aretz tischaru, says Yosef to the brothers. And Rashi explains, tisovavu. You can go around wherever you want and conduct your business. Ve'chol lashon socharim uschora. The very word schora is al shem shemechazrim v'sovavim achrei ha'pragmatia. It's because they go around. They peddle their wares, they're buying here, they're selling there, mistovavim. And that's called sechora. Very interesting. Because the word dar also means something that is round. The pasuk says, for example, in Yeshaya, in Perek Memhei, vahadurim ayasher, that which is curved, I will straighten. And therefore, there are two meanings of the word dar. Number one, to live, and number one, to go round. And that is why the Gemara says, live where you want, tischaru, do business where you want. Two emanations from the word dar. How can you get two? Because the word dar is doubled over, to daror. When the significant letter is doubled over, it's to tell you that there is a duality within this. There are two elements. Dirar is dar-dar. It's two types of going round. What were two types of dira? One is to live and one is lischor. And this is a concept that we find throughout Tanakh. It's very interesting. We might take it for granted. But sometimes a letter is doubled over. It's to tell you that there's two things happening there. And perhaps a classic example of this is from Megillas Esther. How does the fifth chapter begin? Sixth chapter. Balayla hahu nodidosh nas hamelech. The king's sleep was disturbed. Nodidah. Poor Achashverosh was only trying to nod off, but nodidah shenas hamelech. And the Gemara explains, what does nodida mean? There was commotion in the lower realms. There was commotion in the higher realms. Commotion in the lower realms, all the events around that story, and in the higher realms in terms of activating the salvation of the Jewish people. Why does the Gemara say there were commotion in two realms? Says Rav Yehuda Edel of Slonim, in his classic work on Agodas, Iye Hayam, the Gemara is responding to the doubling over of nadada. Nad means to move, like navanad. So nada means his sleep was disturbed. But nadada means there were two planes of commotion. Lamata and lamala. So too with regards to daror. Daror is dar in the sense of living and dar in the sense of business. So this is, again, you see As is so often the case, the closer you look, the more attention we pay to the details, down to the letter literally, the more we open up the words and begin to see how translations that we take for granted, Dror means liberty, but it's built on two concepts, living where you want, doing business where you want, Dar as Dira, Dar as Schora, and everything else then falls into place. With regards to Yovel, and the mitzvahs of Yovel, I must say I came across a great chiddush from the Meshech Chochma. And that itself is not a chiddush. I think if you found a non-chiddush from the Meshech Chochma, that would already be one for the books. But what does he say? He directs our attention to the verses of Yovel, specifically Pasuk Yud Beis and Pasuk Yud Gimel. And let's read them and see what happens. This is all within Rishon. Rishon takes us from Shmita to Yovel. Pasuk Yud Beis. Ki Yovel hi. Kodesh Yelachem. It's Yovel. It's holy for you. Min hasadeh tochlu es tevuasa. From the field, you can eat the produce. What is that referring to? You can't harvest it. It's like Shmita. It's got to be Hefker. You can partake of it from the field. You can't bring it in. So that addresses the element of the what we could call the Shmita element within Yovel. Just like with Shmita, the produce is Hefker, so too in Yovel, the produce is Hefker. Anything else? Yes. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Bishnas HaYovel Azos, in this year of Yovel, Tashuvu Ish El Achuzaso. You shall return each one to his inheritance. Again, referring to the reverting of property, etc. So that is the simple and straightforward reading of the psukim. And it doesn't seem to be problematic. Until you read the two psukim that were immediately prior to this, and you'll see they have already stated all of this. Let us see Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph. Pasuk Yud, which we began to read before, V'kidashtem eshnasa chamishim shana, sanctify the 50th year, Ukrasim deror ba'aris lechol yoshveha, proclaim freedom, as we discussed it for quite a few moments, Yovel hi tielachem, it's Yovel for you, V'shavtem ish el achuzoso, each person shall go back to his inheritance. That is to say, fields that have been sold go back to their ancestral holders at Yovel. So Pasuk Yud has already told us that in the Yovel year, all ancestrally held land goes back to its original owners. Then Pasuk Yud Aleph gives us the Shmita element of Yovel. Yovel hi shnatza chamishim shanat yelachem. Lo tizra'u, you can't sow, velo tiktsiru esefichah, you can't harvest. You've got to leave things where they are. So this puts us in a bit of an uncomfortable position, because it seems Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph have already told us everything that Pasuk Yud Beis and Yud Gimel proceed to tell us again. And the truth is, when you hear the laning on Monday and Thursday and Shabbos, etc., it really does seem to be stating and restating Yovel over the course of four or five psukim. And Meshech Chochma comes in, and he engages in what we would call Tamei HaMitzvos. And he says an incredible thing. As we've identified, and it's important always to note, Yovel has certain aspects in common with Shmita. The Shmita, you don't work the land. In Yovel, you don't work the land. And then it has certain aspects unique to Yovel. Fields go back, slaves go free. So it has a commonality with Shmita, and then its unique domain of Yovel. It really sounds like Yovel has two parts to it. It's Shmita again, it's got the Shmita theme again, and then it's got a special Yovel theme. But along comes the Meshech Chochma and says no. Really, Yovel has only one theme. It's the Yovel theme. Leave Shmita for Shmita. Whatever Shmita represents has been taken care of in Shmita. When Yovel comes in, it is entirely new. It is about the fields going back, what's unique to Yovel. There's just one thing. says the Meshech Chochma. It's not an easy thing to part with a field that you've been investing in for X number of years. People who own fields tend to like to continue to own those fields. And along comes the Torah and says, but comes Yovel, gotta give it up. It is true that the purchase is priced accordingly. It is true. You buy harvests, but you get used to a field. Hard to part with a field that you've been working for all those years. Says Meshech Chochma, along comes the Torah and makes it easier for you. How? How does the Torah make it easier for you to give the field back to its original owner? By distancing you from it, regardless, as per Shemitah. In other words, the Torah says, you know, when it's yours, to give it up to someone else or to give it over to someone else, that's a difficult thing. But what if you have to give it up anyway? And the Torah says, don't work the field and don't harvest the field. So your proprietal relationship with the field has been loosened. It's cooled. Which means now you're ready. And when the Torah says, you know, it's time to give the field back, you're like, okay, it's time to give the field back. I wasn't doing anything with it anyway. What's amazing is, and the Meshech Chochma actually invokes the phrase, which we'll be familiar with from another context, we'll discuss in just a second. Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah deals with understanding of the Yetzer Hara in order to make things work. Where is that from, those words? Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara, from the famous case of Eshes Yifas Toar, from that woman who of the enemy who's found in battle, and there's a whole process as to how to relate to her and perhaps even to marry her at the end. That's where Chazal say, Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah understands in the heat of battle, etc., without going into that whole discussion, but if you say it's forbidden, it may happen anyway, and the Torah does not forbid it. Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. What's most fascinating is this application of that principle in our setting, in our parsha, is very different than the original setting. In the original setting with Eshes Yifas Toar, it should be Osir, but it's hard for it to be Osir, and the Torah therefore didn't make it Osir in that case. So the response, the recognition of the Yetzer Hara, was to give a bit of leeway, again at the risk of oversimplifying. In our case, there's a mitzvah that's hard to do, to give up the field to someone else. And how does the Torah deal with that? By adding another mitzvah that's easier to do, which then serves as a platform to, yes, fulfill this mitzvah, which otherwise would have been difficult. And I think behind all of this is another notion. After all, it's the same Torah which says, back off from the land and give it back to him. But people, I think, naturally are more receptive to losing money to the Torah, so to speak, than losing money to someone else. And it is a known phenomenon. You have people, if they come to the Rav and they have a Shaila in Trefus or whatever it is, they've expended a certain amount of money, 100 shekels or whatever it might be, and they have a Shaila, maybe it's Treif, and the Rav says it's Treif, they throw it out. They are prepared to part with their money if the Torah says it's Aser. But the very same person, the next day in a Din Torah, over 100 shekels with someone else, you'll see how much a person can fight for 100 shekels. And the question is, how come you didn't put up a fight yesterday? If the other person is right and the money belongs to him, it's treif for you. So why was it so easy to part with the money in Yoredeya, in Kashrus questions, but not in Choshen Mishpat? The answer is very simple. In Yoredeya, you lose to a garbage can. There's no shame in that. You're not in competition with the garbage can, but you are with the other person. And to lose money from him, that's a different dynamic altogether. And therefore, the Torah gives you this two-stage easing process. First, back away from the land. That's you and the Torah. Once you've done that, easier to give it over. And this is the Meshech Chochma's explanation as to why the pasuk, why these ideas were repeated. And they were repeated in reverse order. Verses 10 and 11 told you, give back the land and don't work the land, etc. But then it goes back again in 12 and 13. It says it again in reverse order to understand that actually it is through backing away from the land that you'll be able to give it over to someone else. And this is a classic Tame HaMitzvah's exposition of Meshech Chochmah. Meshech Chochmah so often works with the human mind and explains the psukim accordingly. And in fact, Me'inyan Le'inyan, it's worthwhile mentioning another really stunning explanation of the Meshech Chochmah relating to psukim later in our parsha, Kaftes and Lamed. And briefly, what those psukim say, we know that when you sell a field, you sell it to the Yovel, as we said, and then it goes back at Yovel. So it's never a permanent sale. It is a maximum of 49 years, perhaps less. But there is an exception. A house in a walled city. Pasuk Kaftes of Perek Kafhei. V'ish ki yimkor beis moshav ish choma. What if you sell a house in a walled city? Different rules entirely. We don't say it's his till the Yovel. What are the rules here? You have a year to buy it back. V'haysagu ulaso at tom shnas mimkaro. You have a year to buy it back. And in Pasuk Lamed, if you don't, v'im lo yigael ad meloso shalom tamima, if you didn't buy it back within a year, v'kam habayis asher ba'ir asher lo choma latse misus lakone oso l'dorosav. That house remains in the ownership of the purchaser permanently, and from there for his generations. So it's very interesting. When it comes to a field, it's timed backwards from Yovel. You can only sell up to the Yovel. When it comes to a house in a walled city specifically, you've got a year to buy it back. Otherwise, it's for keeps, as they say. It's permanent. And the question is, why, if one may ask? And Meshech Chochmah says something absolutely out of this world. Meshech Chochmah says, what do we know about walled cities? Walled cities, what's special about them is that they afford protection at a time of war. For the people who dwell in them, and even for the people who are close to them, everybody shores up, right? They flow in and they shore up behind the walls. That is the reason, according to the Rashba, why on Purim, when we know that walled cities read on a different day, not only the walled city, but within a certain amount of distance, 2,000 amas outside also reads on the same day as the walled city. Because the point of a walled city is it protects, and there's a certain radius around it, which if there's trouble, they'll enter the city, shut the gates, and be prepared to defend. Says Meshech Chochmah, if walled cities could be necessary to defend against an enemy, if you wish for the population to defend effectively, they will need to act in perfect coordination with each other. That means they need to know each other. Forever. From forever. You cannot have a constantly changing population. If everything is reset in the Yovel, what if there's a battle a year after the Yovel and if everyone's new, no one knows, you don't know what the other person's strength is, you don't know what you can rely on them for, you don't know how receptive they are to or how efficient they are or capable they are. It needs to be a constant population known to each other in order to work well together for what a walled city may be needed for. Absolutely unbelievable. Meshech Chochmah, again, Tamei HaMitzvos. The Pasuk just tells you the rules, tells you the laws. Meshech Chochmah suggests that's what's behind them. A walled city can't be changing. It can't be fly-by-night populations with constantly getting to know your neighbors. You need to know them already when the time comes. And let us conclude by referring to a section at the end of the parsha, which is Pasuk Mem Zayin Tanuv. And we'll see something quite fascinating, how the psukim are again darshaned beyond the setting of of the laws of servants and so on and so forth. Let's begin by reading Pasuk Mem Zayin. V'chitasig yad ger v'toshav imach. What if the stranger amongst you, or the dweller amongst you, not Jewish, that is to say, if he comes into means, umach achicha imo, and your brother, your fellow Jew, actually falls on hard times, v'nimkar, and ultimately needs to sell himself, sell his services, leger toshav imach, to this foreign dweller amongst you, ola eker mishpachas ger, again, another form of foreigner amongst you. Then what? So the Pasuk goes on to say, well, before we see what the remedy is or what the way out might be, let us consult the words of the Medrash, because where we were already not expecting to find it, the Medrash perceives a reference to the four exiles of the Jewish people. Once again, as it moves throughout the Chumash, we have repeated references, each time telling us something else about the exile experience. And how does it begin? It begins with the words in Pasuk Mem Zayin, V'nimkar, what if your brother shall be sold? Says the Medrash, this Medrash Tanchuma, this refers to the Jewish people being sold into exile. And now look at the four terms. Ger, once again, we're in the middle of Pasuk Mem Zayin. Le ger is number one. That's the stranger. Toshav, a dweller, is number two. Imach, with you, number three. And eker mishpachas ger. And eker will translate in just a moment. Says the Tanchuma, these refer, or allude more correctly, to the four exiles. How so? Says Rabbeinu Bachya, I mean, what's ger and toshav and imach? What's it got to do with anything? But Rabbeinu Bachya explains them one by one. Ger is a stranger, and that's the first golus. Because as we entered our first golus in Bavel, we were without a doubt strangers in their eyes and in our own eyes, complete foreigners away from our country. The first time we'd been strangers in another's land for hundreds of years. And ger, therefore, is the first goddess of Bavel, as we were aliens and strangers. But then toshav is a settler. And this is already is the second goddess of Paras. And why is it called toshav? Because what's very interesting about the first two exiles is that we didn't really move anywhere in between them. It's just one morphed into the other. Babylon became Persia because Babylon was taken over by Persia. But there's a difference in our relationship with that exile. The early part of those 70 years, we were Gerim. But as time moved on, we began to settle in. We began to settle down. I don't think we ever had aspirations to become a Babylonian society, part of that. But you had the Jewish people, they're going to Ahasuerus' feast, they're looking to insinuate themselves into Persian society. They're looking to go from ger to toshav, and that's a different type of golus, and the backlash, of course, was Haman's decree. And what's the third exile, and how is it referred to? Imach, with you. And what's the third exile? Yavan, Greece. And why is the exile of Greece called Imach? For two reasons. Number one, they were with you. This was the only exile that was conducted from home, or more correctly, experienced from home. We were in the land of Israel. They were imach. They came to be with us. But I think there's something more. What was especially insidious about the Greek exile is that ostensibly they had so much in common with us. Imach, they're with you. That's the problem. You both appreciate many of the same things in life, just for completely different reasons. But that's the plane of the exile there, when they're imach. And the final phrase is le'eker mishpachas ker. Eker is from the word akira, to uproot, as the Medrash says, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the future will uproot the final golus of Rome. But what is the lesson here? Why are we being brought into the four exiles here? Because the pasuk tells you that there's two ways a person who's been sold into servitude can get out of it. If he has the wherewithal and can finance it, he can get out early. He can pay off and get out early. Otherwise, he'll need to wait for a date beyond which he'll leave regardless. And that exactly mirrors the exit of the Jewish people from the final exile. As the pasuk famously says, Staf Torah for Parshas Kisavo, Ani Hashem Be'ita Achishena. I am Hashem Be'ita in its time, Achishena, I will hurry it along. And the Gemara says, that's a contradiction. Achishena means it happens early. Be'ita means it's the time. So which is it? To which the Gemara famously answers in Sanhedrin, in Perek Chelek, depends on the Jewish people. Zachu, if they are able to amass merit, then Achishena, they'll take the route of ushering in the redemption early. Lo Zachu, but if they do not merit, Be'ita, there is a time beyond which it will not continue, but they'll need to wait for that time. Those are the two avenues available to exit the exile, and they parallel absolutely the way that a person can get out of servitude. If you can afford it, you leave early. If you can pay your way out, you leave early. Otherwise, you need to wait. And this, therefore, is the parting message for the four exiles from Chumash VaYikra, and of course, much to think about. We look towards exiting the exile, depending on who you ask, we're in various stages of that. We certainly haven't finished, that's for sure. And there's a lot of financing yet to be done. But to be aware of these two avenues certainly will encourage us to invest our efforts in the first one. For Be'itar, we do not wish to wait for Be'itar. We certainly don't want to wait past it. We'd like to think that we can go for Achishena, but that, of course, is up to us. Hayom im Bekolo Tishma'u. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Until next week, all the very best. Have a good evening and a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.